Welcome to the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. Tune in to hear leaders in neurology sound off on topics that impact your clinical practice. I'm your host, Marco Meglio, editor with Neurology Live. In this episode, Dr. Greg Pontone, Chief of Aging Behavioral and Cognitive Neurology at the University of Florida, joins us to discuss how cognition is affected in patients with Parkinson's disease and how clinicians can better recognize and manage these changes. Pontone outlines early signs such as executive dysfunction and slowed processing and highlights the impact of commonly used medications on cognitive outcomes. He also reviews current treatment approaches, including pharmacologic and non-pharmacologic strategies like structured routines and cognitive training, while discussing the emerging role of biomarkers and the overlap with Alzheimer's pathology. The conversation emphasizes the importance of early recognition and patient education in improving long-term cognitive care. Let's dive in.
You know, it's very variable. We've had patients who have a long course of Parkinson's with minimal cognitive impairment, and we have others that progress very quickly. The high estimates, so this would be a high estimate of how common mild cognitive changes are, is about 40% at the time of diagnosis. And these are usually in one cognitive domain. So for instance, the executive domain of cognitive function is the one that's most commonly affected in Parkinson's. And that's your ability to sort of organize, sequence, and plan. Another very commonly affected cognitive domain and a very early sign can be a slowing of the speed of processing of thought. And so sometimes we refer to this as bradyphrenia, just like bradykinesia is slowed movement. Bradyphrenia, we think, is slowed thought that sometimes happens in people with Parkinson's.
Well, obviously it affects a substantial amount of patients even earlier on, and then obviously continues to kind of get a little bit worse as their disease progresses. So talk a little bit about medication adjustments. Which therapies can potentially cause more cognitive issues, and what treatments may be used in the clinical paradigm to potentially improve or help some of these problems?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the culprits that's available both as a prescription medication and over the counter are what we call anticholinergic medications. And what these medications do is they block the availability of acetylcholine, which is a brain chemical that we think is very important for cognitive function. And these are also medications that are found, like I said, in over-the-counter preparations like Benadryl. So very common allergy medications. The generic name is diphenhydramine. And these, we think the Parkinson's brain is particularly vulnerable to these anticholinergic effects because it's already producing, on average, less acetylcholine. Another type of medication that fortunately is prescription only is benzodiazepine. So benzodiazepines, you've heard of these, are your, I'll use brand names just because people are probably more familiar, Xanax, Ativan, Valium, things of those nature. They can worsen memory. So they are amnestic agents. They worsen memory. That's proven. And they can also decrease attention and alertness, just like the anticholinergic medications. And they're all of these types of medications, both the anticholinergic and benzodiazepine medications, are associated with increased risk of falls in addition to the cognitive side effect.
So I'm curious, from your perspective, how much do you kind of weigh some of the potential benefits versus some of the risks? And when is it too much on one side versus the other for that kind of thing?
That's a great point. So many of the medications that we use have anticholinergic properties, and benzodiazepines are actually first-line treatments for many of the symptoms we see in people with Parkinson's. So for instance, clonazepam is a first-line treatment for the REM sleep behavior disorder that we see in Parkinson's. Anticholinergic medications are often used to control certain tremor, especially if it's not responsive to levodopa. And so I really think that there's two ways that we look at this. One is the demographic of the patient with Parkinson's. So if they're a younger earlier in the disease course type patient, they're more likely to tolerate these medications without problem. As the patient is older and has more advanced disease, that might be a different sort of computation of risk benefit.
It's very interesting. And obviously, you know, you guys have to kind of walk that fine line sometimes and decide whether it is worth it or not for some of these medications, depending on the patient and, you know, what it looks like for them. You know, Dr. Pontone, obviously we don't really have, we've seen some uptick in therapeutic development over the last couple of years. We obviously, the pipeline is very robust right now. We've had a couple of FDA approvals in the last few years or so, but we really haven't seen a lot that is directly impacted cognition for patients with Parkinson's disease. So talk a little bit about the conversations that are being had within the clinical community about how we could potentially improve cognition and what has actually been done over the last couple of years to really kind of make more of an effort to improve cognition for these patients.
Yeah, that's a great point. So I think we're getting closer and closer to disease-modifying treatments, but we're not quite there yet. There are some symptomatic treatments. They're actually carryovers right now from the Alzheimer's world, but they have good efficacy and proven efficacy in Parkinson's and Lewy body dementias. And so let's start with those. They're acetylcholinesterase inhibitors. So we talked about how anticholinergic medications could cause cognitive dysfunction. Well, it turns out that if you inhibit the enzyme that breaks down that brain chemical acetylcholine, you effectively increase the synaptic availability of acetylcholine. So you're not necessarily adding it exogenously, but you're keeping more of the body's own acetylcholine around longer. And there's at least three compounds in the United States that do this. So within that class, there's options. And you know, once we see significant cognitive impairment, that's something that we often start. And then there's a second medication, again, a carryover from the Alzheimer's world called memantine. And that works by a different mechanism. It's basically an NMDA receptor antagonist. And it's thought that it works by decreasing an excitatory neurotransmitter called glutamate. And by doing so, it sort of preserves neuronal function is the idea. And the reason it's important that these two different drugs have different mechanisms is that they can be used in combination and you'll have potentially a greater benefit than either alone. And so right now that's the kind of FDA approved medications for cognitive impairment, and they're symptomatic. They probably slow decline very modestly. They don't necessarily improve cognitive function. And that's a important message for patients because it's very common that I'll start these medications and they're well tolerated. And then, you know, the patient will come back for their next visit and they'll tell me it didn't get any better. You know, I still can't remember anything. So I stopped the medication. And I say, oh boy, we've got to do a better job of educating people that it's expected that you won't necessarily notice an improvement. But studies clearly show that over time, there's a modest decrease in decline. And so that's an important message. The more important thing, you know, in terms of we talk about this concept of effect size, right, or bang for your buck, is actually things that patients can do by themselves without medication. And these are things like establishing routines and habits, right? Structured activities, cognitive training. And so let me talk a little bit about why routines and habits are so important, because they're actually a different type of memory. It's a procedural memory. So anytime you habituate something, you reduce the burden of performing the activity and the cognitive burden of initiating and performing the activity. And so oftentimes when people are diagnosed, and I've learned this from many of the great neurologists that I've had the great fortune to practice with, they always told me, you know, if your patient has to use an assistive device, teach them before cognitive impairment becomes a problem, because they'll develop the habit. And then when things, you know, begin to change, they'll have already a great skill with this device. And I think that goes to say, you know, that things like apathy are a problem where patients begin to initiate fewer and fewer activities on their own. But if their day is structured and they're in this routine, they flow you know, from one activity to another, literally out of habit. And so, you know, I can't overstate how important this is. And so this is something that in our support groups and our outreach seminars, we're really trying to get the message out to people about how impactful this can be. And the other kind of emerging intervention is what we call cognitive training. It's sort of a step out from cognitive rehabilitation that's been done for decades in stroke, and we're now applying it to chronic diseases like Parkinson's and Alzheimer's.
We're going to take a quick break from our conversation with Dr. Pontone to keep you up to date on the latest developments in neurology. Welcome to the Neurology News Minute. Here's what you may have missed since our last episode. First, on April 16th, the FDA cleared Kala Health's Kick Plus wearable for the treatment of action hand tremor, inessential tremor, and postural and kinetic hand tremor symptoms in Parkinson's disease. This next-generation device, which builds on the Kala Kick platform, was cleared through the 510K pathway based on substantial equivalence to the prior device. Next up, days later, the FDA issued a complete response letter to Grace Therapeutics for GTX-104, an injectable formulation of nimodipine, as a treatment for patients with aneurysm subarachnoid hemorrhage. The agency referenced items in the chemistry, manufacturing, and controls, as well as the non-clinical sections of the application. And lastly, during the 2026 American Academy of Neurology annual meeting, new data from the Phase 3 METEOROID study were presented, with findings indicating that satralizumab met its primary endpoint in a cohort of patients with MOGAD. All told, treatment with the IL-6 inhibitor led to a 68% reduced risk in new relapse compared with placebo over the 58-week treatment period. For more information about these stories, head to neurologylive.com, or you can check out the corresponding link in the show notes. And now, back to our conversation with Dr. Pontone.
Well, building those habits is also not even, you know, it's obviously very key for the patients themselves, but also for the families and the caregivers and things of that sort. It's obviously can have a lot of big downstream impacts for those families. You know, Dr. Pontone, we've kind of talked a lot through our conversation about how the PD community, especially for this topic, is obviously taking a little bit from the Alzheimer and dementia community. And, you know, we definitely want to talk a little bit about biomarkers, which is such a hot topic in the Alzheimer and dementia community. So how has the conversation around biomarkers shifted for PD, especially in the cognitive context? Because obviously we've seen a lot in terms of alpha-synuclein over the last couple of years, but has there been any kind of movement in terms of any cognitive biomarkers per se for this patient population?
Absolutely. And, you know, I wouldn't say that we're quite up to par with the Alzheimer's world yet, but there's also some utility potentially for some of the Alzheimer's biomarkers in Parkinson's, because about one third of people with Parkinson's who have significant cognitive impairment also have Alzheimer's changes in their brain. And so it may be that if you're seeing a patient with Parkinson's who has maybe a greater than expected burden of cognitive impairment, you would potentially be able to use Alzheimer's biomarkers, either the p-tau217 blood test that came out last year or amyloid PET, to see if they had this comorbid process along with Parkinson's. That's one. And then, as you mentioned, you know, we have alpha-synuclein seed amplification, which is, you know, beginning to support the diagnosis of Parkinson's. There are other less specific plasma markers, for instance. You can also get them from CSF, things like neurofilament light chain. We think there might be potential, not just in Parkinson's, but in other diseases, to say something about the trajectory of cognitive changes in the disease. I think already it's fair to say that you can look at patterns of atrophy, cortical atrophy and atrophy in other areas, and derive some indication of cognitive change in Parkinson's. You know, we can't quite apply that quantitatively, but we can still use those structural changes on MRI. And then, of course, PET scan, which is a functional scan, we can look at cholinergic and dopaminergic function in different areas of the brain. So I think, you know, we don't have anything necessarily FDA approved for as a cognitive biomarker in Parkinson's, but we're getting very close.
Yeah, I mean, I hope to see obviously even more momentum and movement in this area in the next coming years. We've certainly seen the Alzheimer and dementia field explode over the last couple of years, especially with some of these emerging biomarkers. And now we're even getting a little bit more clarity on which ones have a little bit more value than others. I know kind of leading the race right now is kind of that p-tau 217, and, you know, still a lot of other relevant biomarkers that are right behind it as well. Dr. Pontone, a lot of great insights from you. I have one last question. So thank you for taking your time out of your day. So this one last question, kind of a big forward-thinking thought. You know, what else does the clinical and the research communities need to be doing and focusing on in the next coming years to further advance this conversation about cognition in Parkinson's and hopefully maybe bring us to that point where we are improving cognition and not just stabilizing it for patients right now?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think there's actually things that are accessible today that we could be doing better. And so one is earlier recognition, right? So you pointed out early in the conversation that we focus a disproportionate amount of our attention just on the movement symptoms of this disease. And given that we know that at least 40% of the people who are at the time of diagnosis carrying some cognitive change, I think we need to maybe implement more routine screening, you know, in this patient population. The other is maybe a bit more ambitious, and this is, you know, will be great in Parkinson's, but I think it's good for all aging populations and all kind of neurological diseases that involve the brain, is better brain health education. You know, what can patients be doing to fortify their cognitive function as they age or as they manage a chronic illness like Parkinson's disease? And this ranges everything from physical exercise to diet, sleep. And then one that I think not many people consider, but there's now great data on, which is socialization. I mean, the risks of being socially isolated for brain health are incredible. You know, and some studies show up to a 50% increased risk of all-cause dementia in the aging population. And then, of course, more research. I think now that we're able to better visualize structures and function within the brain and we're developing biomarkers, we now have markers of targeted engagement for new interventions. And so I really think it's an exciting time to be in this field, but there's still some low-hanging fruit that doesn't require any additional technology, just sort of better awareness and education.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. To support the show, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, for more neurology news and expert-driven content, visit neurologylive.com.